Hello everyone, my name is Tim Mikelashvili. Welcome. It's my pleasure to speak to all of you. We're live on LinkedIn, on YouTube, on Facebook, and today we're going to be discussing a very timely topic, how we receive and how we deliver virtual healthcare today. We have a group of pharmaceutical industries professionals, those who are committed to the innovation in medicine, in the pharmaceutical industry, medical devices, and biotech. We've formed a group called All Out Pharma Digital. We have a special guest today, and we're going to also discuss how healthcare professionals, physicians engage digitally in this era with pharmaceutical industry professionals, medical science liaisons, and others. As you know, we're currently undergoing lots of challenges with the new Delta variant of the pandemic. We find ourselves once again in a tremendously difficult and uncertain times because of the COVID pandemic. And when our healthcare is undergoing a transformation and a revolution of sorts, how we deliver and receive care is being redefined as we speak. But it's during these difficult and challenging times that we often come up with some of our best discoveries in medicine, similar to Isaac Newton, who changed the world really with his theories on calculus, on light, wavelengths of light during the London Plague. And so it is the question today of, do you think virtual care is here to stay, that we're going to address? We're going to debate and discuss this topic. And before I introduce our guest, Dr. Warren Wexelman, I want to share a few of the latest data and some statistics on the trends of how it is actually that our medicine is being redefined as we speak. So let's start with a recent article from July from Nature Science Medicine Journal, which responded to this question that telehealth is here to stay, provided a very positive and very promising outlook of digital health. Up to $250 billion could be shifted to virtual care. That was the prediction last year. Only 1% of primary care visits in Medicare had been conducted virtually in January of 2020. And that increased to about 50%. Almost half of the Medicare patients received virtual care in April. So there was a huge shift, huge transition and increase from January to April of last year, as many of us have witnessed. Now, we have seen virtual care being delivered even by Amazon, apparently. We've seen lots of great case studies of cognitive behavioral therapy delivered as software as medical devices through digital therapeutics, virtual therapy of residents through the smartphone app called Talkspace, and a range of others as well. Well, there are still concerns. There are concerns with the privacy of the data. There's high variability of how that data is being tracked and governed. But the legislation is supporting this transformation with the Telehealth Modernization Act that will expand the access of virtual care for many more patients in rural areas and others as well. Will allow all healthcare professionals to deliver virtual healthcare as well, and the patients to be the sites of care, their homes. I had a personal episode last year. I had a meniscus for which I had to receive this surgery, and I had some symptoms that recurred during the pandemic. So I called my physical therapist, and he was able to arrange a telehealth visit, after which he showed me several exercises that I was able to do and just drastically change the, you know, and improve my symptoms. I think for many of us, it has hit, you know, a personal note as we are growing accustomed to how we are receiving healthcare. Now, it has stabilized, it looks like, based on this analysis from McKinsey. While it had increased by 38 times in April 2020, it has stabilized now. And so we're going to ask Dr. Wexelman for what he observes right now at Maimonides Hospital. The trends seem to demonstrate that a lot more companies are investing in digital health, as you can see from this graph from McKinsey. And not only is the spending being increased, but so are the revenues. And there are various different types of healthcare that may be transitioned to virtual, from what we have accustomed to see as in-person visits. There are different forecasts that have been made. I think a lot of them are quite ambitious, but we're going to debate that here. And please make sure to comment, ask us questions you have, or your experiences or data, other statistics. But some of the concerns are coming from the elderly population, aged 50 to 80, surveyed last year, for whom that physical touch was missing prior to the pandemic, and that may have become even more pronounced as a result of virtual health. As I mentioned, many of them receiving care virtually. It's the quality of care that is being discussed and debated among these elderly patients, that personal connection. And then also having difficulty seeing or hearing healthcare providers. For many elderly patients, and that's a reality. That becomes a problem when you're delivering care virtually. And then the privacy that we talked about as well. Now, the McKinsey analysis also provides a breakdown of different fields of medicine. Certain specialties may be more appropriate than others for virtual healthcare. As you can see, psychiatry is at the top of that list. Many people are redefining also mental health, anxiety, depression. We know that COVID leads to many patients who complain of loss of memory. There's more recent data that shows that it's not COVID among many of these patients, but it's actually that chronic stress that all of us are exposed to, whether or not we're diagnosed with COVID. We're going to ask you about also what are the types of visits that may be virtualizable, that may be virtual. Is it a routine visit? Is it an annual wellness visit, or maybe a visit to a psychologist? And as you can see in this graph from McKinsey, again, a visit to a psychologist has the highest proportion of patients, about 40%, who receive that type of care via telemedicine. I also mentioned the different telehealth apps, digital apps. And there's one that's being developed by MyMe.com. And this is going to be one of our subsequent sessions that we're going to host here on LinkedIn Live. Mehdi Derberg, she's actually a patient who had suffered from various different autoimmune diagnoses herself. And she's the CEO of MyMe, and she has developed an app that has partnered with Oscar Health in New York that has relieved many of the symptoms of that COVID long haul, with some data as well that show that there is improvement in pain, improvement in the fatigue, and they have a team of scientists, nutritionists, and physicians who help track the symptoms in real time. So the questions that remain, right, the challenges really that we're going to get into the discussion now are largely the convenience. How convenient is it? How accessible? You know, can everyone in all areas of our country, of our cities, really access telehealth? And then how can you expand the patients who may be appropriate for telehealth, telemedicine? Maybe those who have chronic symptoms, or hospital at home models, or post-acute care models. So those are some of the areas that I'll frame for discussion. Our guest, Dr. Warren Wechselman, whom I've known for many years, probably about 17 years. And so he's the Associate Chief Medical Officer at Maimonides Hospital, and also a cardiologist. Dr. Wechselman, it's a pleasure to have you here.
It's nice to be with you, Tim.
Thank you. I'd like to ask you how you think that telehealth has impacted the quality and the access to care from your perspective.
So let's go back to your mention of Sir Isaac Newton. That's the guy with the apple, if I remember correctly, fell on his head. Probably during the London plague, when he had nothing else to do, he sat below the tree, the apple fell. There's an old saying that necessity is the mother of invention. You have a lot of time on your hands and you're in trouble and you need something, you start to really figure things out. So clearly he had a lot of time during the London plague. The problem is that when we're sitting here right now in the midst of this ongoing pandemic, you know, we've had to use things that we never thought in medicine we'd use before. You talk about digital health. That's the topic of today's conversation and what I think. Let's go back to the basic tenets of doctor-patient relationships, all right? Doctor-patient relationship is probably the single most important thing, piece of healthcare that there is. Having that relationship with, it used to be just your physician, now obviously it's with any of the various providers who provide healthcare, like nurse practitioners and PAs, nurses, techs, etc., to be fair to everybody. But if we just sort of look at it as the doctor-patient relationship for the moment, it's based on an interaction and a closeness and a connection with doctor and patient. And the way we do that, and the way we're taught to do that actually, is by touching the patient, physically touching. So I have, as a cardiologist, a dozen different ways to know what a patient's pulse is. And most of the time, frankly, it's not even relevant to what I'm seeing them for that day. But here's what we do. We take our finger and we put it on the pulse. Not because I want to count how many beats they have in 15 seconds and multiply by four. It's to connect and touch the patient, to have a physical bond. Psychiatrists, psychologists, mental health care workers rely on that to be able to work and connect with the patient by having that transference, that connection. So what digital health has done, because it had to during the pandemic, was really try to connect in some way to the patient. Now, of course, during this pandemic, we've had to use resources that we never thought about using before. Telehealth, as you call it, as we call it, the ability to do examinations or to have some sort of interaction with the patient obviously became real. I will tell you that if we go back for the last, since 1968, when Medicare first started in the United States, there was a code for physicians to speak and bill patients by telephone. Really, the first episode of telehealth. Why is it never used? Because they won't reimburse for it. So in other words, if I spent 20 minutes on the phone with a patient and I sent the code in, they would say thank you, goodbye. However, telehealth during the pandemic changed it. And now there's tremendous reimbursement, or at least there was tremendous reimbursement at the beginning of the pandemic for doctors and patients to interact. And indeed, it was the only way. Many big medical systems, big healthcare systems actually forbid their physicians and practitioners to go to the office for obvious reasons at the beginning of the pandemic when people were dying and we didn't really know much about it. So telehealth was the only way. Telehealth was the only way to grab the patient and keep them in. And it's unfortunate because so many patients either weren't able to use telehealth or were too scared to reach out to a doctor. And as a cardiologist, several of my patients died at home, not even from COVID, but from cardiac reasons because they were afraid to get healthcare of any kind. So telehealth afforded us that possibility. What happened to telehealth afterwards is as the pandemic started to cool down a bit and patients were starting to go back to doctor's offices that were open. I know we went back 2 weeks earlier than our healthcare system would have liked us to do, but we needed to. Patients and doctors stopped using telehealth. Let's remember something about telehealth. It's really good if you're just talking to a patient, but to physically hear and see lung sounds, heart sounds, to examine, to touch and feel, it's just not there. So telehealth at its present level now is very, very limited. Now, you showed graphs, and I hope everybody saw those graphs that's watching via their devices, that psychologists and mental health care workers, social workers, are using telehealth to tremendous benefit. And that's real, and that's good, because frankly, they have the interaction. But for a general internal medicine patient, or for a cardiac patient, or example, if you had gone to your orthopedist, for example, right, and had to have them examine and feel your knee and your meniscus, it would have been very difficult. So we go on our experience. You know, I think I've told you before, I used to always say about healthcare, about being a doctor, it's not that hard. I could do this at home in my pajamas, and just on the phone. And in fact, that's basically what we did during the pandemic with telehealth. Well, I didn't really wear pajamas. I kind of wore just nice clothes. At the end of the day, there are some things that you can't do. So I think it has its place. I think what you will see is obviously the curve goes up in the beginning of the pandemic,
right?
Levels off during the pandemic, and then it drops down to a point and will stabilize. I think there will be physicians, because there are tremendous incentives now from insurance companies, from third-party payers, to use telehealth, and they will use it. The quality of what that is for patient care, I think that's the issue. The next issue is you got to level the playing field, and you sort of mentioned this in your opening remarks. Let's remember that not everybody has multiple devices and broadband everywhere. In fact, many of the areas, the socioeconomic areas that need constant health monitoring, don't have internet capability, don't have tablets or devices, all right? And if we're going to offer telehealth, we better offer them the means to get to the telehealth. And then let's look at the biggest users of healthcare, the older population. And I say that with a smile on my face,
right,
as I am part of that population right now. You met me, I was a lot younger.
But you look just as young today, by the way.
Thank you very much for saying that. I appreciate it, and the check will be in the mail, Tim. But, you know, if we look at our seniors, all right, technology is not something that comes easy. You know, the 40-year-olds of today, who will be the 60 and 70-year-olds soon, they will be very familiar with it. But our 80-year-olds, our 90-year-olds, and our 70, some of our 70-year-olds right now, find it very challenging to understand how to use these devices. So if we're going to do it, we got to make them easy. We got to make them available. We have to make them financially appropriate, both for the end user and for the practitioner. And we haven't gotten there yet. So there are still lots of challenges. Will it find a place? Yes, it will. All right. It certainly will. But is it going to be the answer to everything? No. But I think in medicine, Tim, there's no one answer to everything. Everybody's different.
Sure.
Every disease is different. Every disease within everybody is different. I think that's why you have to, in healthcare, we all, whether you're in pharma or whether you're a practitioner of any kind, you need to keep an open mind and be flexible so you can move left or right. You know, I'm far from an old guy in technology. I'm not. I have my own software company now.
Yeah, let me talk about that. Yeah, with our audience.
Well, my software company, which is called AlphaMed Disease Management Systems, or AlphaMedDMS.com, we've created numerous things, including an electronic healthcare record and many apps, many applications that are used in healthcare. But when COVID started, my partners at Alpha Software, the platform that I use based in Massachusetts, came to me and said, can we write some applications for the COVID virus, which was actually very easy because there was nothing out there a year ago March, and the government, we weren't getting answers to. So we created what we called COVID Care, which you can find on the internet now if you go to alphasoftware.com or alphamed-dms.com. You can find COVID Care, which in the beginning was an application that looked at what are the real symptoms of COVID, because at that time there were too many false notions about COVID going on, especially from Washington, and the risks that you had of getting COVID, and then the risks you had of getting very sick based on your medical history from COVID. Now, we are one of the larger providers of software for kids to go back to school throughout Massachusetts and Philadelphia. There are over 18,000 children that are using our apps to go to school safely every day by judging their symptoms and temperature. And we also have a Back to Health app. So I'm not a stranger to technology by any means. I write software, I build systems, I lecture on it, obviously. But many physicians, especially the older physician, who are still active and engaged medically and in practice, are not necessarily the biggest users of digital care. So you see, there's still digital healthcare is still in its infancy. And if we're going to roll it out when it's not life and death like the beginning of the pandemic, we really need to think clearly, how do we engage everybody? How do we engage all of the practitioners of all ages? Because remember, a lot of your older physicians have the largest practices, and they have the loyalty with the patients. So the patients will go by their word. And if they can't see them, and if they can't interact, there's nothing there. So indeed, you know, we've got to be able to figure how to get it, how to get everybody that's practicing the art and science of medicine, as well as how do we get all the patients? How do we ensure that they will have it? And I think that's where government and the insurance industry and pharma can really work with us.
How realistic is that adaptation for many physicians when there is still a need to shift the mindset from a fee-for-service to a value-based service when you speak about telehealth? Do you think that the structures are in place for physicians to be incentivized to use telehealth right now?
But let me give you the biggest version of that. Actually, at the beginning of towards the end of the Bush administration, they came up with the idea that everybody should be, every physician, every healthcare provider in hospitals, clinics should have a healthcare record. You know, the VA, the US VA has had healthcare records since the 1970s and early 80s. And it's really worked very well to make healthcare information available about veterans. And during the Obama administration, the idea of meaningful use came out. And what it was they incentivized all of us to get an electronic healthcare record and adopt it and use it. It's very interesting. So what they did is they gave us $44,000 if we got a healthcare record, used it, and then gave certain information to the government about how we were using it and about the patients. That was for Medicare. For Medicaid, they gave us in the 60s, 1,000. But when you count up what they were charging, it cost for installation and to have a tech, you were right in the red from the very beginning. Plus, healthcare records, mine not included, electronic healthcare records, are not designed to be quick and painless and easy for physicians to use. In fact, physicians hate using their electronic healthcare record. It takes them three times the amount of time to see a patient. And what does that mean? Either they're going to work longer and burn out, or they're going to see less patients. We're not accomplishing what we set out. So the incentives didn't cover it. The healthcare records itself that we're using are horrible, and physicians hate them. And the patients suffer, because when we started using the major healthcare, electronic healthcare record, 5 years ago, patients would wait in my office huge amounts of time for us to log them in the beginning when they first come in, and for each office visit by going through their history and all the things that were required. So the idea is good. It just wasn't done well at all. But here's the worst part. All of the major electronic healthcare record systems, like Epic and Allscripts and eClinicWorks, there's a free one that physicians use, they were never designed to share the information everywhere. Now there have been some laws that said you must be able to have that information available to patients right now. But to share it between systems, they weren't doing. So you see, it's a good idea. It's vital. We need to share information. We live in a world where this conversation that we're having from where you are in Brooklyn and where I am in Brooklyn right now is probably going all over the world in seconds, milliseconds.
Right.
But my prescriptions, not available to anybody else. And what medical problems I have, not available to somebody outside of the system that I may be logged into. So you see, we're in its infancy. It's like everything else. In time, it will progress. But right now, getting a physician to adopt, you know, there was a time before the pandemic when the electronic healthcare record was not being used. If people think that every physician uses an EHR, oh no, not by any means. Or more now than ever before. And incentivization helps, but it has to be the correct incentivization. You know? And our doctors, let's face it, I can tell you, having been a doctor for over 45 years now, doctors only work when there's a gun to their heads. All right, and there you go. So yes, telehealthcare has stabilized because now we have the ability to see patients again back in our healthcare centers, our offices, our clinics. You know, the pandemic is heating up again, obviously. The Delta variant of COVID has, you know, created a huge new pandemic of the unvaccinated individuals. And they're utilizing healthcare now by, you know, not their will, but they forced it. So we're going to see it start to climb again. And I'm worried, you know, where we're going with this because we haven't reached the herd immunity and too many people are unvaccinated. So at the end of the day, we're going to see telehealth go up. Especially with vaccine patients, with people that have gotten the vaccine still having a low degree of ability to get the new variant, although they don't get as sick, thank God, and they don't die, all right? But they still can become COVID positive, and we see it every day. So we're going to continue to use telehealthcare. You know, yeah. And the idea is we're going to need to develop better digital healthcare. We're going to need to develop the ability to hear a heart and hear a lung, which I think there are some digital appliances out there that can do that, but they're not widely available and they're expensive. So the government, if you want government politicians, if you want the industry, the healthcare industry to get to digital healthcare, insurance companies, you must incentivize the ability to buy these devices and have them available for home use. Right now, I was medical director for a company that did remote patient monitoring, heights, of weights, blood pressures, oxygen saturation, and temperature during the beginning of the COVID pandemic. It's really great, but the devices cost $300. So most people don't have that extra money laying around, especially in an economy that's based on unemployment. So we need that third party to get in there and really make this work with us. We need to partner with them. Pharma too, same thing.
Yep. Yeah, I was showing a few slides there as you were talking about the different types of care that may be diverted, in-person care that may be diverted to virtual care, even home administration, pharmacists, doctor pharmacy training, and so are many others in our group that we formed, All Our Pharma Digital, across different companies. Do you think that telepharmacy even has a role? Is that something that's promising? And I've spoken to other leaders and for the pharmacy profession.
You know, when I was a young kid, you know, a real young kid, back before they invented electricity and you know, we actually, when I was sick as a child, my parents called our local pharmacy, which happened to have been across the street, what we would now call a mom and pop, you know, store that has been put out of business by big pharmacy stores. And they would have the prescription ready in 15 minutes and would be happy to deliver. That sort of went away a lot when, you know, the big chain stores came in. But now in the pandemic, remember, necessity, the mother of invention, we went full circle to where everybody starts to deliver. So the first part of telepharmacy is being able to get that prescription to the pharmacist, all right? And then to get that medicine back in the patient's hands by delivering it to them, especially to our older folks. Absolutely, there he is. At the end of the day, you know, this rule now that you have to send the prescription via computer and they won't take it by phone, where are we with that nonsense? Because I'm always near a computer system that I can just stop while I'm driving and call in some life and death medication to a patient, right? And they're telling me, no, we can't accept that by phone. Well, you have no choice. How does that make the situation better? So it's like one step forward, Tim, five steps back. We need the ability to be flexible. We need the ability to say, if you need it, we will get it for you. You know, and we do that sometimes, and then we shoot ourselves in the leg.
So we talked about technology there, but I'm still experimenting with technology.
Apparently.
So, as you were speaking about that, the quote, right, necessity is the mother of all invention, I believe, right? I actually was finally able to show that the image of Sir Isaac Newton.
I went to school with that guy because we all had long hair back then, or hair.
Okay. Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about the pharmaceutical industry, because I think now pharmaceutical companies are going live on LinkedIn, you know, such as Pfizer, Boehringer Ingelheim, and, you know, they're redefining what competition is, and they're going from competition to collaboration. Companies such as Boehringer Ingelheim that I saw a couple of years ago that unveil this new initiative, cross-company initiative, to improve the clinical practices, the clinical study, recruitment, enrollment, and just standards, raise the standards, where they invested a lot of resources into training other small startups with the aim of improving the quality of these pharmaceutical trials. And so the next topic that I had promised everyone to speak about here is, how are physicians engaging virtually with pharma companies? I'd like to show just a few slides and then have you provide your insights. And those who are actually logging on and are live on LinkedIn, please ask us your questions, your comments about how you're engaging with physicians and with medical affairs professionals, with MSLs, as they're known as well. I looked at some research from University of Scranton to answer the question, why healthcare providers use social media. And they've summarized 5 different uses, you know, providing updates on new technologies, improving quality of care, training each other, right? Broadcasting live cases from the operating room, and managing crisis as well. Many physicians, they also shifted towards attending virtual conferences to educate and to engage with each other over the pandemic. But they preferred the real-time presentations, so oral presentations rather than attending posters. And yet, pharmaceutical industry, the biotech and, you know, medical devices, they are investing lots of resources to bring that education to healthcare professionals virtually. Right. And so there still are challenges, as this survey of over 300 physicians showed, in terms of them not attending these virtual exhibitor halls. Among those attending, only 25% of them attending these exhibitor halls that are sponsored, and then only 50% of them actually contacting an MSL. And, you know, Dr. Wexelman, I'll tell you that I had the pleasure of interacting with 4 different cutting-edge scientists at a virtual conference live, whom I would otherwise probably not been able to, you know, contact in a virtual conference, thanks to the technology, in one event. That yet there were others in which that became much more difficult to do. It wasn't as simple, and became impossible, in fact. So the Medical Science Liaison Society, which we have in our function, which is a nonprofit organization, it conducted a survey of physicians. And it asked them, how important is it for you to maintain your contact with medical liaisons during the pandemic? And 26% said it was very important, with the rest, ranging in terms of their opinions, from somewhat important to not at all important. And then if you look at how receptive they are to engaging virtually, to your comments earlier, you'll see that 34%, about a third of them, are using Zoom, Skype, WebEx to engage with medical liaisons, whereas the rest are still in that transition, you know, or not as receptive to it. But when asked about how frequently they prefer to communicate, you know, previously as a, you know, medical liaison for 17 years, the standard usually was for us to interact with physicians once a quarter. You know, when there was some new data, new updates to our label or product. Well, now it seems like that has increased, where physicians now and scientists, investigators are looking forward to interacting maybe more frequently, but for shorter periods of time, once a month, for example. But finally, the final slide that I want to share with everyone is that when they were asked, should MSLs continue to utilize virtual technology in the future, there was an overwhelming response, about two-thirds that definitely, that agreed, you know, that they see the necessity, you know, they want to continue to engage virtually. So I want to ask the same question of you. You know, how have you engaged virtually with medical liaisons, such as us here at the All Pharma Group?
Dr. Wexler. It's a lot of data. So let's start from ground zero, all right?
Sure.
The term pharma has become almost a dirty word in the world, unfortunately.
Yes.
And so I think we've all been responsible for that. Providers, physicians, pharma, everybody, reps, everybody. The reality is I have been working with pharma closely, both in studies as well as a lecturer for pharma with four major companies on the things and drugs that I use and are passionate about. And that's how you and I met many years ago.
Right.
Where would we be today without pharma? Forget about the last 100 years, all right? Let's just talk about the last year and a half. Where the heck would we be if there was no Pfizer and Moderna and AstraZeneca, to name just three, let alone the people that make the antibodies, all right, in various different companies? Where would we be? There would be millions more deaths. And, you know, you might say, well, sure, they make money for it. Well, everybody works. Everybody works for a reason. It's not because we love getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning and working 12 hours a day and then coming home and going to bed. We work because we have to sustain ourselves just like everybody else does. So, yes. Could it be better? Yes. Could pricing be better? So it doesn't sound like all we're doing is making huge amounts of money and choking people to death. Yes, clearly. But where would we be without pharma today? We would be sick and dying. That's number one. Or we'd be chopping up leaves, again, in the forest and sucking them down, praying that maybe they'll have an effect. All right, that's where pharma's taking us. So this nonsense about pharma being a negative word, and I don't want to interact with pharma, and I want nothing to do with pharma, it's just stupid. All right, it's time to get over that. Things have to be in a certain way. Yes, you know, nobody should be bought to use medications and therapies. No physician, nurse, whatever, should ever be done that. But I think most physicians are really, really upstanding human beings that are just here because they took an oath, and that also do no harm and take care of the patient. So let's take care of that first. Now, you talk about during the pandemic and how you use pharma and technology. You know, yes, I interact very closely. There are many MSLs from the companies that I deal with, that I'm close with. Two that come to mind right off the bat, I don't know if they're listening, but at AstraZeneca, Danielle Longo, who I know you know from the past, Danielle and I are very, very close. In fact, our families have become personal friends with each other. And I rely on her because she is on top of everything in the scientific world of the medications that I use to take care of patients every day. Janet Mastodono, who is my MSL from Novartis, all right, on Entresto and other drugs.
Thank you for recognizing them. That's,
you know, these are people that I'm close with that I speak to on a regular basis. Why? Because they are like you, Tim. You're not just a pharmacist that works in pharma. You've been an MSL for years and years and years. You are on top of all of the cutting edge research that I'm not going to hear about for months or maybe years. And that saves patients' lives. Now, I will explain to you some of those slides you showed. First of all, how physicians use social media. They left out one thing there. They use it as an advertisement, all right? And they use it as an advertisement to get the word of their practices out. But everything else in that slide is real. But the average physician in practice, whether it's in a private practice setting or a hospital-based practice, for the most part, doesn't necessarily need the MSL because they're using their therapies, at least in their mind. The fact that an MSL would come to them, a medical science liaison, would come to them and say, I can give you all the latest research on anything you need. Please use it. It's like Google. They're like amazing. Danielle and Janet are like Google. You know, you ask them a question, it's there. They can be a tremendous resource that I think most physicians have not really been opened up to. And understand that a lot of physicians now, that are practicing in large healthcare systems, all right, are not allowed to see reps. The healthcare system keeps the pharma rep out, which is wrong. And the idea behind it is they say, well, you know, you can't control samples and things. I wrote software to do that. All right, Secure Samples is my software. It's nonsense. It can be done. But more importantly, they feel that their providers are being bought. Because, yeah, giving me a cup of coffee is certainly just what you need to buy me any day of the week. I got news for you. That ain't happening. It never did. So
thank you so much for bringing reality and that real world perspective.
We have
a lot of people listen to this.
We have to, because it's nonsense. Are there bad physician and practitioners that do the wrong thing and are swayed by this? Clearly there are. But you know who they are. You know who they are. You don't go to them. You don't deal with them. All right? But for 99% of the providers of all types in the United States of America, they're upstanding good people that are there to serve, all right? And so keeping information away from them is a disservice, and it's wrong. So many of these healthcare systems don't allow pharma reps in, and they don't allow MSLs in. And their practitioners are losing out because of it.
Yeah.
You know. So I think there's a tremendous value to it. And I could not imagine, all right, especially I try to stay as best as I can on the cutting edge. You know, I lived all over the United States. I need to know when something breaks, good or bad. And, you know, before I'm going to get it online,
yep.
You know, my MSLs reach out to me right away and say, I just want you to know that. And when the FDA approves something, it may not get to CNN for a few days.
Yep.
All right. But my MSL gets it to me that day or the next morning. So seriously, if physicians aren't using MSLs, and their reps the way they can, they should be. My device rep, Vinny Iacono, from the Abbott pacemaker division, I couldn't function without him. I really couldn't in the pacemaker world because it's way too broad now. It's not just one device. We need these professionals.
Yeah.
You know, these are not salespeople. These are professionals that we rely on to help us do our job and practice safe and secure and state-of-the-art medicine. So it's time we cut the nonsense out. There are people out there that are dying because they can't get enough health care. There are practitioners out there that are starving for information. Pharma can lead the way to doing this. And we working together as one group, as one partnership, saying that we are not going to do the wrong thing, that we're going to do the right thing, and you can test us. And you can follow us and you can track us to make sure that we are. That's fine. All right. Working together, the healthcare industry, whether it's the federal government and state governments and pharma and the insurance industry, practitioners working together, we can make healthcare what it should be. I've told you many times, and I've told my lecturing audience, there are three basic rights and fundamentals in this world, in, as far as I'm concerned. The right to have a roof over your head.
Right.
The right to have food to eat and water to drink, let alone healthy food to eat and liquids to drink. And the right to healthcare. We live in a country that has by far the greatest healthcare minds that ever existed. Sir Isaac Newton and the Apple had nothing to do with what goes on in American healthcare today. We are privileged to have the greatest minds in the world here. But everybody needs access to them. And that's what we need to strive for.
Yeah.
My two cents.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'll just comment what I see from physicians and some of the research that you made me think of as you were speaking there about, you know, physicians really using others, other professionals from the pharmaceutical industry as important, valuable sources of information in this era in which we live, where physicians themselves are probably confused in terms of where they get that data, you know, online, Google. It's not just about getting the access to information, but actually consolidating that into your memory that most of us, whether or not we're physicians, pharmacists, whomever we are, we're having trouble with that, with our attention span. And so I think that's where the medical liaisons can come in order to help have real conversations, conversations that matter, in order for physicians to then decide whether or not that treatment is suitable for that patient. Because I think, you know, you mentioned the sales reps, right? I think the sales are in, you know, are they're actually in the field, and they help physicians get access to care for many of their patients. Whereas medical liaisons are also, or medical affairs professionals, right? And the pharmacovigilance, medical information, there's various different, you know, disciplines within our function. We provide the information. We're in the business of information, as you alluded to get physicians to understand who the suitable patient is. So there's no need to, I think, to have a firewall that's too rigid between the field sales and medical. We are in together in that continuum of healthcare.
You know, you miss one thing that I think is still even vital. Everything you said is right on the money. Mm-hmm. But the basic tenet of pharmaceutical sales reps is they bring me samples. They give me state-of-the-art, cutting-edge meds that save lives. Drugs like Farxiga that are saving lives in heart failure. All right, Brilinta, all of these drugs that are the studies, the science shows are life-saving. That the insurance companies, PCSK9 drugs, statin drugs for all these years. All right, the insurance companies won't pay for. I have my patients using those samples to get the healthcare that saves their lives. And you want to restrict that? When companies are willing to give that, yes, they make money because we end up putting patients on the drug, of course. And should they cut back on some of the prices? Yeah, they're too expensive. There's no doubt it needs to be fairer. And everybody needs to be able to afford it. It should never afford it. There should never be a question of, do I take my diabetes medicine today or do I eat this week? There should never be that in this country. All right? There never should be. And we all have to work together for that. But the ability to use cutting-edge medicine and pharmaceuticals in patients who need it, that would never have access to it. Never. That's what this industry does. And that's why I'm so passionate about it. We can regulate it. We can do a lot. We can make changes that will make it better. Clearly, we're not there yet. We go from here to here. We need to be here. And we can do that because we're smart. The whole group, we're smart people. We can make it work. Let's do it together. And let's make the difference.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your.
I don't get passionate. I'm very level. I.
No, that's what has made me actually feel like I've spoken to you, even though I haven't seen you for a while in person. That's what I remember from all of our conversations, Dr. Oh, Ruxman.
And thank
you. You're an incredible, a tremendous spokesperson, in addition to being a physician, a clinician, a leader for healthcare, for being a more progressively minded healthcare professionals and those who are tied to the healthcare profession, from the pharma, from medical devices, from biotech. The years that people spend in experience does not provide the final picture. It's actually what you do with that experience, what you do with that technology. I've even seen data that the years in practice for many healthcare professionals actually are associated with lower quality of care, even before telehealth, because of some of the healthcare professionals who are not willing to actually see or entertain new ways to receive data and then there's on the other side of the extreme. You know, I'm not here forming this group, All Out Pharma Digitals, trying to just sound like I'm relevant here, because digital transformation sounds like something that everyone is talking about. We're critically addressing it. We're using it deliberately in a similar way that you are to read a book. You know, before you read a book, you want to, in order to consolidate or to apply to your practice or to your life, you have to create some kind of goals or notes from it. Right? What am I going to learn? What am I going to take away from this book, this information? Right? So that's what we're doing. We're trying to see, okay, maybe there's data integration problems. Maybe there's privacy concerns or that patient-doctor relationship that you talked about. And so I'm so glad that you provided a lot of balance today in this discussion, in this digital transformation, because that's really, that was the goal of our discussion today.
You know,
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. I think we should sort of leave it on this for everybody that's listening.
Sure.
All right.
Yeah.
In 1978, in May of 1978, I raised my hand and took an oath.
Yeah.
That oath I've lived by my entire life. At least I've certainly tried to every which way I could. And I never forget that oath. We all take an oath. You did it in pharmacy school?
Absolutely. I have it in my other office.
Of course. And we all do what we do because it's the right thing to do. And I think that physicians or practitioners, pharmacists, nurses, anybody out there that forgets, you know, if you go back to Star Trek, which so many people have lived their lives by, there was always that concept of the prime directive. You could never violate the prime directive. In healthcare, the prime directive is do no harm. And always remember, it's the patient that you're here to take care of in all ways. And taking care of that patient means staying current, utilizing every opportunity there is, no matter where it is, whether it's an MSL or a digital interface or whatever you perceive it to be, to take care of that prime directive individual, the patient. That's what we're here for. And we can never lose track. And when you talk about physicians losing track and not, you know, healthcare quality going down, it's because they've gotten tired, they've gotten beat up, they've gotten lazy, and they forgot why the hell they raised their right hand to begin with. And we can never, ever forget that. None of us can. And when we remember it and we live our lives by it, right or wrong, good or bad, not perfect, no one here is perfect, we'll do better. So let's never forget that.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Wexler.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you for having me on today.
Absolutely. And feel free to be our guest in the future as well.
Just invite me.
We will. Have a great day, everyone.
You too. Take care. Be well. Stay safe.